This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In the last decade, the term fracking has become part of the national lexicon. Fracking, hydraulic fracturing, has actually been around for decades. It's a method of extracting natural gas or oil by drilling down into the rock, sending a viscous fluid under pressure, fracturing the rock. That allows the fossil fuel to escape, and then it's pumped out. The reason it started to become more well-known is because of a development called horizontal hydraulic fracturing, and that's changed the whole scenery. Instead of just drilling down, technology was developed to turn the drill bit horizontally and frack along the rock for long distances. It also led to more complaints about contaminated water wells, in some cases some minor earth tremors, and it also requires a lot more fracking fluid. That means a lot more water, and it mixes with chemicals, and once it's retrieved, it's no longer usable. That has a lot of people more than a little concerned. A new book, a collection of essays, stories, and poems about fracking is out. It's called Fracture. The anthology was edited by Taylor Brorby and Stephanie Brooke Trout. Stephanie Brooke Trout joins us now along with Marianne Lessert, an associate professor at Grand Rapids Community College who wrote one of the stories in Fracture. Stephanie Brooke Trout, you gathered almost 50 writers for this project. Why did you think this collection was necessary?
Well, Lester, we knew that the public needed to know more information about fracking, but at the same time, we knew that the public needed artistic representations of fracking. The poems, the essays, the short stories in this collection, they're everything that headline news isn't. And they really give you the sense of the personal experience of fracking. Whether we're talking about the roughnecks actually working in the field or the landowners who now have drilling on their land or are experiencing some of the consequences from a pipeline leak. So we wanted to collect as many diverse perspectives as possible on the issue, really to just show the public how complex the issue is and get us out of this two-sided framework. Fracking is good, we've been doing it for decades, or, you know, fracking bad, and to really unpack the issue and give people a sense of the real experience of it.
Stephanie, what do you think these writers have said that we haven't heard in the past?
Well, the writers have said fracking is not just an environmental issue. It's not just a political issue. Fracking is a personal issue, and it's touching their family lives. It's affecting their employment. It's affecting their personal relationships, friendships, fallouts. It is more than just what we hear in the headlines and from the sound bites.
Marianne Lessert, your story is fictional, but the descriptions in it hint you've spent some time around some fracking sites or former fracking sites. Is that right?
That's correct. As a writer, I went out, and I kind of affectionately now call it my boots on well sites research stage. I spent some time reading all the science about fracking, understanding the process, and then what I really wanted to do was write from a more sensory level. What's it like to live with fracking? So I spent a lot of time with people living next door to frack well sites, being out on the sites themselves, talking to people in the industry, seeing, smelling, hearing, you know, feeling the drill rig vibrating through your body kind of thing.
Would you read just a bit of your story for us?
Sure. I'll read the opening paragraph, which is the ultimate out of balance. We came to know that fracking can look uglier and uglier depending on who, ultimately, is in charge. From the rusty sheet metal welded to the framework of their 136-foot-tall monster of a drill rig, to the messes they left behind, Dillon sites, we soon discovered, were pure carelessness and slop.
So when you visited these sites, what was the thing that struck you the most?
One of the things that I found that was really, really important as a researcher was meeting people who were living near these sites. And there are people that have stuck in my mind for years. And I think about those people and how much they really felt that telling their story about what fracking was really like instead of reducing it to, I mean, I know we need science. We absolutely need science. But they also wanted people to understand just how different their lives became. For instance, an elderly couple living in Kalkaska County, Phyllis and Bernard. I met them in June 2013, And when I walked up, they were all bent over their water well with their water well driller, watching their pump suck air. There was an Encana well site around the bend bordering their property. The fracking operation had demanded several water wells to be drilled, and their water well was literally running dry. The other thing that was happening is the silica sand was literally pluming up for 20 and 30 feet into the air and falling like huge clouds onto the neighbor's house. Their neighbors had been evacuated because the yellow-white dust of the silica sand covered their home. And so I spent the day with these people who were, first of all, afraid to touch the tap water out of their own tap for fears of chemical contamination, and then it ran dry, or at least was filled with air. And the other thing was they could see visible evidence right in front of them, a 20, 30-foot tall plume of silica dust that I photographed over their heads by their small wood meadow farm sign. You know, and it's that idea that home is not home anymore, that your absolute sense of home is shaken.
Stephanie Brookkraut, you not only were a co-editor, but you also contributed to the collection. Basically, your essay starts out, why we don't want to hear about fracking. Would you read a little bit about that and then kind of summarize your points for us?
Absolutely. So my piece is called Hear No Evil, and it's sort of a list, 10 reasons why we don't want to hear about fracking. And this is reason number 5. We don't want to hear about fracking because we don't like your alternative. If the solution could somehow be linked to consumerism, if we could do the things we love without fracking, we might be more inclined to listen. But you are asking too much. Your valuation of the future is too high. Some of the other reasons in the list, the third reason is the not in my backyard argument, which is, you know, sure, we don't want this in our backyard. We don't want our own watersheds contaminated with fracking fluids. But, you know, as long as it's somewhere else, somewhere that doesn't matter, then it's okay.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. Yeah.
I saw Bill McKibben not only submitted a piece, but his group 350.org, which is a climate change movement, was a partner in putting out this collection. He's pushing to find ways to limit the use of fossil fuels, but the argument is made that natural gas emissions account for half the carbon output of a fuel such as coal. Is fracking an inevitable interim step that the market forces require? Marianne, would you address that question?
Well, I don't know if I can answer, you know, from a market forces perspective, but I do know that one of the things that's sometimes misleading about the language is the idea of natural gas being a cleaner burner. And, you know, from what I've seen, smelled, tasted in the air, there's a whole lot of off-gassing from all of these valves, wellheads, tanks, things that happen on site. And when you study the whole range of things that happen in fracking, from the original drilling to the storage to the movement of liquid and dry gas to the processing, there's a lot of studies that have shown that there's a whole lot more methane and volatile organic compounds getting off-gassed into the air, which in a net way makes natural gas not cleaner. I guess in a market capacity, I, as a consumer, as somebody who wants to buy clean energy, I would love to see us devote our talents and our innovations, which I know we have, to local community-owned sources of power, wind, solar, cleaner technologies.
Stephanie, I'll ask the same question. I mean, we've got this cheap natural gas because of fracking, and people like it. They like the cheaper parts. We see coal-burning power plants shutting down and switching to natural gas because it's cheaper. Is this an interim step that's just going to happen no matter how much opposition there is to fracking?
Well, I think those are sort of two different questions, whether or not this is going to be an interim step versus whether or not it is wise for this to be an interim step. Natural gas does emit less carbon into the atmosphere, but it emits much more methane, which is a much more dangerous and more powerful greenhouse gas. Also, when we talk about it being cheaper, we're talking about the cost of extraction alone. We're not talking about the cost of the fallout the public health hazards, the cleanup. We just had news of the Enbridge pipeline spill from 2010 just reached a $177 million settlement, which is the largest penalty for a Clean Water Act violation in U.S. history. That doesn't sound cheaper to me.
I saw on your website, Stephanie, that StephanieBrookTrout.com, that you've been doing readings and book signings. What kind of response are you getting from the people you're seeing?
We're getting an incredibly powerful response. People are really excited to be learning more about the issue and to be really learning more than just the science, but more about the personal experience, more about the history. People want to have real conversations about these issues and not just sort of a back and forth shouting each other down, neither side is going to give an inch, but to actually discuss these issues that are affecting our state and in our country and our world.
That's Stephanie Brooke Trout and Marianne Lesser. That book is Fracture, a collection of essays, poems, and stories on fracking in America. They will be appearing in Traverse City at Horizon Books on Saturday, August 6th. You'll both be there, right?
Absolutely. Correct. Along with Stephanie Mills.
And Tuesday, August 9th, they'll be in Pellston at the University of Michigan Biological Station. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having us, Lester.
Thank you, Lester.